National Treasury representatives, and we also have members of the public present here, and I also see that we've got the media. You're all welcome. This is a very important part of fiscal policy in the country. As you all recall that during the budget speech, key amongst other important matters that the minister raised was the tax proposals. Subject to that, we then had public hearings on the 1st of June, where National Treasury was present. After we as the committee had received a number of submissions from the public, we gave National Treasury the opportunity to go and look and interact and engage with the stakeholders on both those submissions, written and oral. Now National Treasury is coming back to report to the committee and give us their responses on all those issues. And we'll take it from there. Because we are meeting you for the first time, Momo and your team. The last time we met when we're dealing with the South African Reserve Bank Amendment Bill, we did welcome everybody and embrace the spirit of togetherness and oneness, which was displayed by all South Africans during the World Cup. And then we'll continue to feel it and touch it, though Philip is gone. But we're still here. Thank you. We are in your hands. Okay, for record purposes, we've got an apologies, two apologies from Mr. Mudimele and Mr. Swart, Honorable Swart. They are both honorable.
Thank you, Chair. I guess we should characterize life today as BWC and AWC, before the World Cup and after the World Cup. So the last time we were here was BWC. Chair, can I just introduce, thank you for the opportunity, and can I just introduce ourselves? My name is Ismail Momoniat. I'm Head of Tax and Financial Sector Policy in the National Treasury. Keith, you want to introduce yourself?
I'm Keith Engel. I'm Chief Director of Legal Tax Design, Treasury.
Cecil Morden, Chief Director of Economic Tax Analysis.
Franz Tomasek, Group Executive, Legislative Research and Development at SARS.
Really,
one of the things that National Treasury may have to consider is a tablet called SlowMag, which releases energy very slowly. For the sake of our understanding, when Keith speaks, you must actually give him SlowMag before, a night before he comes here.
Done that, but you can see he's still very active. And then I should add, Chair, that and members, the most important people are behind us, is a few from the Treasury, and over there, Greg and John and others who do all the hard work. So just want to acknowledge them as well. Chair, I think as you've outlined, and I don't have to spend too much time, I think today is really just a response, as you indicated that the bills were published on the 10th of May. We had a briefing on the 18th, and you had hearings where representatives, I like to say from the public, but I guess mainly from business, were there, and certainly written comments. In addition, we also get written comments from whoever wants to submit. We've received about 60 written submissions. There is an action that we have today which just outlines from whom we've received comments. And then I think, obviously, we like to say that we do hear and take very seriously the comments that we receive. And some of these can be characterize rather than just meet people. I mean, sometimes we do have to individually. We try and just have workshops along themes, because a lot of the issues that are raised are often tend to be common issues. So we had four workshops, Treasury and SARS, firstly on international and business tax issues, secondly on individual taxation issues and administration. Certainly the royalty issues came up, and we also had one on Islamic finance. I should also add that, Chair, although we're here for the tax laws amendment bill, the CO2 emissions tax on cars is not done through the TLAB, but done through the the Customs and Excise Act, and the regulations in terms of that act. But even there, we followed a process where we've published these for comment on 2 July. We've received 4 written comments, but we'll be responding to that as well, just so that, you know, you have a coherent picture over and above the bills. So, Chair, I think today all we are doing then is really, and you have this document, and we say it's a draft document, which tries to capture on all the key points, the comments that we've received, and to indicate to you what the response is of Treasury and of SARS. After this, so we'll basically just provide a presentation which highlights the key points that are in this document. We put this document out to the public as we do, this is the main document, and after we've been to the hearings, because members may still have comments, we'll finalize this document, and the idea is then we'll table the amended bill, because from the original bills, we then amend the bills, having heard the submissions, having heard the comments today. These are then tabled, which we hope will be done by the end of this month. So that's when you get the formal bills table, but they already incorporate the changes that we've discussed today. So I think that is just to remind ourselves of the process. What we have then on the presentation is, as I said, we just work through these issues. These are the areas that are covered in terms of the TLAB, and we'll also cover, of course, the carbon tax in this presentation. Okay, so maybe just the team, I think various people have taken responsibility for certain areas, and will share this presentation. Keith, over to you.
Yes, no, I mean, all you have here is what we've highlighted here are the biggest issues. There were a number of changes made, and you can see the document is quite long, but we didn't want to go through a bunch of minor stuff, and you'll see a lot of adjustments were made. But here, I think, is the biggest policy issues that we're going to discuss today. And we've broken down according to our lines, individual savings, business, international royalties, administration. But in order to make sure you wind up before I start going too fast, Cecil thought he would start the wind-up, and he'll take care of the first issue.
Thanks, Chair. The first two issues I'll talk to is on the motor vehicle and then the interest exemption. Next slide. The initial proposal, Chair, was that we will amend the inclusion rate for fringe benefit for motor employer-provided motor vehicles, commonly referred to as company cars, from 2.5% to 4%, and we'll also change the deemed value on which the car is based to include a maintenance plan and VAT. Then we add a 80% withholding, which brings down the withholding, monthly withholding, to 3.2%. That was the proposal. After comments, second slide, we've managed to get some additional data that help us to refine the proposal. So the proposal is now to reduce the monthly inclusion rate to 3.5% instead of the 4%. And that seems to be corroborated with data that we got from various players. The deemed value we say that it's very difficult in some instances to separate the maintenance plan from the actual car price, because some cars you buy, it comes with a maintenance plan inclusive. And then you have to go through an exercise to try to dissect it. We've looked at a few examples, and what we're proposing is that by default we will include a maintenance plan in the price of the vehicle, but we will allow a deduction of 0.25% for maintenance plan. We'll probably drop the word full there, because there are different levels. There's a service plan, a maintenance plan, and a full maintenance plan. And the most common one seems to be the maintenance plan. And so we will reduce the inclusion rate for fringe benefit from 3.5 to 3.25. What's not on the slide is that we will include VAT as part of the deemed price, because VAT you also pay as you, especially in the individual, and even if it's a company, in terms of the VAT Act, VAT input credit is not allowed for what we refer to as passenger vehicles, and we'll come back to the definition of passenger vehicles later when we discuss the CO2 tax. Then there was a big issue that people use their cars for businesses predominantly, and what was called as a tool of trade, salespeople and so on. And so the question was, how do you deal with that people that the car is hard, the use for private purposes is very small. And so there the concession was that the pay as you earn, instead of the 80% rule, we can go down as far as 20%. And that apparently also is a reasonable average for people like salespeople that predominantly use the car for businesses, and the indication is that an estimated figure of 20% is reasonable. However, there is a clawback there. Should that 20% in the end seems completely out of line, the employer will have to take co-responsibility for the miscalculation and is a potentiality of a fine. I'm not sure if you want to add something there, Frank. Okay. That deals then with the motor vehicle, Chair.
Just for members, just go back to the first. I think the format we have for the presentation is you have the initial proposal, which Cecil outlined, and then the next one that he talked through, just to the next one, is the revised. And this is the format we have for all the rest of the slides.
Then the next issue, which also generated quite a lot of comments, and I think it's a very important issue, is the interest exemption, tax-free interest that we have. And initially this proposal or this provision in the Act was what is called a de minimis rule, just to deal with people that earn very little interest in terms of trying to go after them, so you ignore that amount. If it's too small, why worry about it? It turned into a tax incentive sort of for people to save. The question we're asking ourselves, does it really do the trick? Does it really help people to save or encourage people to save? And also, it turned out that this might be used for other purposes, for tax planning purposes. So that was the concern that we had. And the proposal was to restrict it to certain types of investments. And there you see the list for which we proposed it to be restricted. However, the next slide. Having listened to all the comments and the unintended consequences of this particular proposal and some sort of misallocation of resources it might result in, we are withdrawing this proposal completely. However, we will consider this whole proposal or the whole provision and see whether we should come up with some alternative mechanism to really incentivize savings, or is it really worthwhile trying to incentivize savings through the tax code? But for now, Chair, this proposal is withdrawn. Thanks.
Okay. Then the issue that we're dealing with, executive share scheme. Not sure where that's coming from. When we have under the original proposal, what we have under our general rule is certain rules to make sure that when employees receive shares, that they'll be taxed as ordinary revenue, as salary, because that's what the shares really are. So we don't create incentives for executive share schemes. And as discussed last time, there are a number of
new, there's always new opportunities in this area where tax planners are trying to convert that salary into capital gains using shares. We had some proposals to restrict some of those avoidances, and what one of them was if you hold a restricted instrument. Now, what happens to a restricted instrument is you hold a share, but you're not allowed to sell it for 5 years. Those are the things that we're worried about, because those kind of things, the real value is sitting in the company 5 years and cashing out later, and that really is equivalent to salary. We had a proposal that said that if you received any distribution on a restricted share, that would be taxed at ordinary rates, because that's a cash out of the share. And then simultaneously, there'd be no deduction for the employer, no SDC. That one created a lot of problems. I'm going to go back and forth on this slide. But the on the revised proposal, that there was concern that there were many BEE deals that were set up where the BEE players were getting dividends in order to finance the shares. And therefore, if you tax the dividends as ordinary revenue, you would undermine the financing. And so we've adjusted the proposal for the main concern and said we will treat dividends as ordinary revenue only if they are shares that are not ordinary shares, that they are restricted preference shares, because that was the main concern. What would happen is certain executives would get a share, and the share would ultimately be worth nothing, but what they would do is cash out on the share via excessive dividends, sort of a self-liquidating share. So we limited the anti-avoidance to a very narrow level, and we said this is treated as an ordinary revenue, and it's sort of a no-go area. If you fall in here, you're sort of in the worst of both worlds, because there's no reason to hold a preference share in a restricted way as an employee. It just doesn't make sense. But we've narrowed the proposal, and I think we've solved the BE issue of concern. The second one that's come along is that we have problems policing this. Now, the original legislation says if you acquire shares and you're an employee and you get the shares by virtue of your employment, then you're subject to the taint. But what we found is that taxpayers have interesting ways of factually determining things. And what we said in the original proposal is if you acquire shares and you're an employee and those shares are restricted, we're not even going to get into the factual analysis. We're going to say these are restricted shares and they're subject to the anti-avoidance rules. That proposal is being modified slightly because the original proposal unintentionally captured all employee acquisitions of shares. So if an employee went out and bought shares on a JSE, those would be caught. And we felt that's unfair. I mean, if they're buying like shares like anybody else and they're unrestricted like anybody else, there's no anti-avoidance. The anti-avoidance is when they get these restricted shares, because it's the restricted share schemes that you're trying to convert salary and hide that salary from share distributions and through shares. So we modified that proposal as well. And again, expect continued action in this area. We keep seeing new avoidance, and one of the difficulties we're having is making sure that we keep up the avoidance while not undermining economic activity. But there is a strong push, again, to try to disguise salaries. This is a smaller issue that turned out to be much bigger than we thought, and that was we have certain rules under current law that says if your employer takes care of your professional subscription fees, that those professional subscription fees are exempt. The main purpose of the proposal was to also add an exemption if the employer covers your indemnity insurance, your malpractice insurance. But we also went and we changed the language on the professional fees in order to clarify the law. However, there was a lot of opposition to that, and basically, given all that opposition, we really were just trying to clarify the law. We weren't trying to do something fundamental. So when it comes to actual professional subscriptions, your SAICA and your doctor, your accreditation and all of that, after all the comments received, we're just keeping the law as it remains, that if it's a condition for your employment and that the employer requires, then it remains exempt. And that's current law. People seem happy with that, and we won't change it. However, we are adding an exemption for indemnity insurance. So basically, I think taxpayers will be happy with that change. Then, another issue, this is a smaller issue, but it does affect a number of players, and that is key person insurance plans. Now, what we're trying to do when it comes to employees,
that sound keeps coming through. Nothing on my part.
Is, as a general matter, what we want when it comes to fringe benefits is that if the employer gets a deduction,
you know, over there.
Okay.
Oh, the computer might be close to it.
Now we went out there.
No, it's somebody.
I think the cable may have come loose.
Oh, okay, we did something. No, it's connected there.
No, it's the projector.
Look here.
Technology, don't you love it?
Yeah, looks like all the buttons are in. You're doing what I'm doing.
There's no signal there.
Okay, my problem is I got to see the slide.
Here's the button.
Okay. The main issue here is key person insurance plans. You all have your slide on page 6. What basically the theory of fringe benefit taxation is that the employer has a deduction and it's providing a benefit or salary to an employee, the employee should have a simultaneous inclusion as salary. There should be a matching concept. When it comes to fringe benefits and insurance, that's generally the case, but they've actually developed a number of different ways of doing an insurance. And one of the areas that we were concerned about was key person insurance plans. And in the key person insurance plan, the argument is that what the employer is trying to do is not help the employee, but what the employer is really trying to do is take out insurance on the employee over concerns about lost profit. So if you lose your key employee, your key clients will be gone and all of that. And in that case, what the current law says is the employer gets a deduction, but the employee doesn't have an inclusion because the insurance is not for the benefit of the employee. However, there was a number of scheming that went on in the area where people were trying to disguise the plan as a plan for the employer when it was really a plan for the employee. And what the original proposal was to do was to tighten those rules and to make sure that to the extent it's for the benefit of the employee, it's for the benefit of the employee. So what we've basically done is we've clarified the law. And what the law basically says, if it's for the benefit of the employer gets a deduction if the employee has income. However, if it's for the employer's benefit, it must be a genuine key insurance plan. But we've made the plan a little bit more flexible, and that was what some of the comments were. There wasn't too many. I think most of the industry accepted that this area needed to be reformed. They just wanted to provide flexibility for a genuine employer key plan where it was for the benefit of the employer. And the key changes that we made is, one, we clarified what these were. One, these plans have to be pure risk plans without any cash value. But two, that the employer can actually cede the plan to a creditor. Because sometimes what happens is the company will borrow money from the bank. And as insurance for the bank, they want insurance on their loan. So you give the plan to the bank, and that's now going to be allowed. A third thing we're going to allow that was requested was that these plans can be ceded to the employee before maturity. Because what happens sometimes is the plan is for the benefit of the employer, but then the employee is going to retire. Now, if the plan has got no cash value, all the employee wants to do is to continue to pay the premiums. Because otherwise, if they have to go out and get their own insurance, it'll be very expensive because they could be age 55 or 60, and getting insurance at that age is very difficult. So the employer can cede the plan, and it doesn't have any cash value, but the employee has the benefit of the lower premiums going forward. So that's now been permitted. The other issue that we had to address was some transitional relief, because some people have done this planning and now they're trapped. What we did is we said, look, if you're in these plans, we're going to allow the employer to shift it to the employee tax-free, so it can roll over to the employee. The employee got the previous benefits that that existed in the plan. However, going forward, there'll be no future deductions. So they'll basically, whatever benefits they received will be frozen and accepted, but going forward, they won't get any new benefits. And that's where we went there. Okay? And again, I'm just not sure what's going on with these slides, but all right. Now, on business, just the two issues that are in front of us are, the first issue is the financial instrument mismatch schemes, and the second one is on the liquidating residential property entities. The first one was fairly contentious. Now, what we were trying to do is we're worried about schemes where you're basically arbitraging the tax system. And what the biggest worry of the tax system, and I'm going to jump the slide for a minute, is if you look at the bottom of page 8, I've given you a simple example of a mismatch problem. It's a little overly simple, but it shows the point. If what you try to do if you're doing aggressive tax planning, not that anybody would ever do that sort of thing, is that what you're trying to do is make sure that the economics don't match the tax. And what clever people do is they play games with simple math, and that's what this chart is showing you. And what happens is, if you borrow money, you get a deduction. But if you receive a dividend, it's not taxable income. And the reasons why it's not taxable income, unrelated to the discussion here. Now, if you borrow money to buy shares, basically you borrow money to get dividends, there is a mismatch scheme that's fairly straightforward. And that is, let's say you borrow money and you have to pay 100 rand of interest, and you buy a dividend cession right. Well, what happens is, actually I've got my minuses and my pluses wrong. You'll pay out interest of 100, that's the minus, but you'll receive dividends of 100, that's a plus. I have a minus there. So you pay out 100, you get 100. Well, economically, well, nothing happens, so nothing very exciting there. But the tax system says you have a minus 100, but you don't have any corresponding plus. So for just doing nothing, you've managed to reduce your tax bill. Because economically you have a minus and you have a plus, so nothing, and then you just have a simple minus. Now, under current law, we have the basic judicial law that prevents the simple mismatch scheme. And the basic judicial doctrines work. But what people do is they do more attenuated schemes. And the concern that we had was one court case even allowed people to do the mismatch scheme called the Standard Bank case. Now, the case is being misapplied, but still people are using that as a precedent to allow these kind of mismatch schemes. And what we had proposed to do was to be very specific and require tracing. And we said, if you cannot prove that the money borrowed is not, if the exempt income you receive is not connected to other sources, that we're going to create the anti-avoidance rule and deny deductions. And so what we required was a very firm tracing rule, in essence. That proposal was not greeted too happily by the taxpaying community, and that's on the top of page 8. But they felt that the proposal was overly broad. And we've had serious problems dealing with this proposal. And so what we reluctantly withdraw the proposal. And the concern that we had in the proposal is, while we want to stop the avoidance, no matter how hard we tried, what we found was we were either overly broad and we hit many innocent transactions that we didn't want to hit, or we were so narrow that we didn't hit anything. So we couldn't deal with it. And one of the problems that we had was we were trying to put legislation on a specific aspect of judicial law, one piece, without touching all the other pieces. And you can't do that. If you're going to do it, you've got to do all or nothing. And that was after many... So at the moment, we are withdrawing the proposal. However, we do take a note of strong concern here. We are very aware there are many dividend cession schemes and other financial schemes designed to do a very complicated form of mismatch. And we are going to have to come back on this issue in a more direct way. So this area is not over, and I think you will see continued activity here. But we have very, very strong concerns with financial institutions and others, where basically you're going out and you're planning and you're just reducing your tax bill with sophisticated tax planning. These are rife, and as a matter of fact, in the comments that we received, there were some commentators who were honest enough to say, I think you're not quite sure about your proposal, but we do see what you're trying to do, and we agree with you. And so we will be back, and hopefully next year on that subject, although that is up to the minister, but I do think we're going to come back on this issue. We can't allow people to arbitrarily undermine the tax base. Then another issue now, which is much smaller, but it's generated a lot of emotional heat, is these liquidating residential property entities. I don't know if Bonds wants to go on that, or no, he doesn't want to get near that thing. So the point is, this issue, we were trying to be nice, but we're never nice enough. That's really essentially what this is about. Now, Ambrosini's giving me a look. He never thinks that we can be nice, but sometimes we can be nice. They won't admit that to you, but sometimes we are. The what happens here is this, to go back, is that when you have a many people years ago try to avoid the transfer duty. And the simple way to avoid the transfer duty was if you bought the house directly, you had to pay transfer duty. So that was not something you wanted to do because it cost you money. So what people did is they put their residences into a company or a trust. And then they sold the company or they sold the trust. And lo and behold, you avoided transfer duty. And that was quite successful up until about 2001 or 2002. And it was quite a little popular. I guess some people's memories are coming back. And anyhow, they did this little thing, and they were quite happy until we changed the law. When we changed the law, we ended that. So if you sell a company that mostly contains, that the majority of the value is a residence, your house, we're just going to tax the sale of the company as if you sold the house. And you don't want to go in that area because we will blow you apart. We fired the elephant guns, and we did what we did. Now, in addition, you have another problem because the capital gains tax was added in. So they were not only having now the transfer duty, but the capital gains tax created a double charge. Well, anyway, back in 2002, we said, look, we've got you in the vice. We're going to give you a one-year period to escape. We gave them the one-year period, but maybe they didn't believe us or whatever the reasons. They didn't take advantage of it. And a number of people were still left with this thing. So in 2009, we decided to create another window of opportunity to let people terminate these entities. And so we created our 2009 regime, and people complained that it wasn't flexible enough. And we also made a mistake in the 2009 regime, and that was we have a quid pro quo in this thing. I like to throw Latin every once in a while, but it's basically what we're saying is that if you're going to get this relief, you've got to do one thing for us. Liquidate the entity. Save us the administration. But when the 2009 regime was drafted, we inadvertently forgot the termination part in the law. So a number of people moved them around and didn't do what we wanted to do. So we went back to revise the regime this year to make it more flexible, but to require that you terminate the entity. And that was the proposal. Now, again, a lot of people thought that was somewhat helpful, but they didn't think it was helpful enough. And one of the issues was that the original proposal required you to give back the property to the original funder or their spouse. And the complaints were that sometimes the original funder is already dead, so how can we go back? And it's just not flexible enough what we've done to the structure since. And we had some strong concerns here because we originally were trying to help people who were just avoiding the transfer duty. And a number of people weren't just avoiding the transfer duty, but they were also avoiding the estate duty. However, after long consideration, we said, look, if you've gotten away with the estate duty, and given the fact that it's under review anyway, we'll let you get away with the estate duty, which is not the best, but we'll let you out of this regime. And so what we've done is we've created the regime and made it much more flexible. So I think that should make people quite happy. What we're saying is all you've got to do is terminate the entity. If you have a multi-tier structure, like a trust owns a company, that was a big issue for people. Well, I can't get out of this thing. We say, fine, you can get out of it, but you've got to terminate both the trust and the company. So if you're going to help us, You get rid of your complex structure, we'll let you go out tax-free. And it doesn't matter whether it goes back to the spouse or not now. So it can go to all the family members. It's a much more flexible thing. And there were some other requirements that were moved as well. And I think basically you've given away most of it. I guarantee you, though, you'll get a comment or two that somebody wants something more. I think there comes a point where enough is enough, but this was quite a big concession. Now we've got the slides back there on international. Okay, now this is frankly the biggest issue, I think, of all the issues, so I might take a little bit more time with this. Sure.
Yeah, I just wanted to check with honorable members whether we should pause here and enter into some deliberations on the first part before we go to the international part of it. Or honorable members are comfortable that we should take the entire presentation. Luyen?
Chair, my suggestion would be that let's take the entire presentation and note the questions where we want to engage the department on later.
Yeah, you had time to drink water, kid.
Okay. The biggest issue before us is on the international side, and that is on cross-border interest. Under current law, we have, if a South African borrows money from a foreigner and pays interest to that foreigner, as a general matter, that interest is exempt. And that the main purpose of that is to attract for foreign portfolio investments, government bonds, listed bonds, bank debt, and so forth. However, while it was important to attract foreign capital, there was a very strong concern that what we had done was not in line with international practice. Now, most of the world has an exemption, but it isn't as exempt as we've made it. Our exemption is pretty much blanket across the board. Most countries just limit this exemption to more narrower categories of foreign borrowing. And that was the main concern of the proposal. Now, if you go over to the next slide here, just to show again the basic math, if you take a look at debt versus equity, i.e. shares, you have two different results. If you pay dividends offshore and you have a company earns 100 rand of income, it will get taxed at 28%, and when the money goes offshore, it will be subject to the STC. So you get two levels of tax. The foreign person receiving the dividend is generally exempt. That is the basic paradigm. Now, we are changing that in the future with the new dividends tax, where the STC will then be taxable by the foreign payee. But when we made this change, we wanted to make sure that we preserve the dividends tax, and so therefore we're negotiating a number of treaties where we're allowing it to be reduced to 5. So what you see basically is the classic double tax system. However, if you pay interest, you have 100 rand of income, but if you pay out 100 of interest, that reduces the income to 0. And then if the money goes offshore, it's exempt. So what you find is interest can not only is the money going offshore exempt, but the payment of interest can actually undermine your corporate income tax base. And Corporate Tax Planning International 101 is to use debt to undermine the tax base. That's one of your first starts if that's what you're going to do. There are other things like insurance, royalties. There's a little thing. I went to an IBFD conference where they have like a list of 10 things. And the first they do is debt, and they give you a little list as to what you do. Anyway, the point is that while we're trying to encourage foreign funding, we don't want to undermine the domestic tax base. And that's the main concern. Now, if we move on to the next slide, what the initial proposal was to narrow the exemption so that it only applied to portfolio debt capital and trade finance. Because in the world, people are trying to, governments are trying to attract debt. And so generally what you find is that most countries exempt the portfolio debt. So if a government issues a bond, it's exempt. Or if a listed company issues a bond, it's exempt. And you find that once the U.S. and the U.K. and Germany and these other guys have gone zero, in order for us to attract the capital, we also have had to go to zero. But that has only applied to the portfolio, the mobile flows, not the immobile. And the other one that you see exemptions for is trade finance and a few other minor areas. So we've narrowed our exemption in line with that international practice to those categories of listed things. It should be noted that we have a number of treaties. What mobile is that, look, there's certain things you can do very quickly without much work. So if you want to buy a UK government bond, you can do it. There's nothing, it's mobile. Anybody can do it. It's very easy. It's available for the retail investor. So there's certain kinds of capital in the market that flows very, very quickly. And that capital moves in just based on the slightest change of interest. And one of the issues that you see in the cross-border interest area is that money moves very quickly. So if you drop your interest rate from 10 to 9, a number of investors leave immediately. If you tax it, they leave immediately, and they move to the next source. And they will move at the smallest of fractions. So that's what I mean by mobile portfolio capital. The immobile stuff is if you have to go get a loan from a bank. That takes you 6 months. Could be a year. So your more commercial private financing is much harder to arrange and much harder to escape from. But your mobile capital is stuff that you can get in and get out the same day. It's kind of Wall Street capital. Think of it that way, or London LSE or JSE capital. That stuff you don't tax because the moment you tax it, it leaves. However, there are countries that are now beginning to reconsider this. Brazil and China, for example, do tax it. So I'm not sure where there might be change in the air, and I know there's a number of other issues, but we haven't touched that. That is remaining exempt as before. Trade finance you often exempt because it's often irritating in deals to tax that. Trade finance is typically when you import goods or you export goods, you'll have letters of credit and various kind of things to secure the goods. And the amount of interest tends to be very small and incidental, and you find that's also exempt. And that's generally what we've done here. And so basically the proposal is to go after the other forms of debt. And there's a number of arguments on the next slide for and against. And the case you can argue all day, what's more important to you. What you hear from us is we're trying to keep in sync with international tax practice. The issues that we have also is that if you allow a blanket exemption for interest, the main concern we had was a foreign-owned company has an advantage over a South African-owned company. And that means that actually our companies can be takeover targets because they can acquire them and just use the interest deduction to generate better bids. And we have seen this. Mm-hmm. So there is risk on that side. The other one that's also bothered us, and we talked about this before, is these funnel schemes, these circle schemes. Because it's private arranged debt, you'll see that there are many deals where the money goes offshore, is tax exempt, and then comes back onshore tax free. And what happens there is you're basically just doing a big circle in order to reduce your tax bill. And the schemes are quite attenuated. They can be 10, 15, 20 layers. And unless you get it at the source, you'll find you really don't get it at all. There are other issues here. I mean, those are some of the basic issues. The taxpayer issues, and they're not illegitimate. It's a balancing issue here. So it's really a question of balance. That one of the things they say is it's going to increase the cost of foreign capital. Well, if I borrow the money and it's going to be taxed, well, the capital is going to be increased. On the other hand, when you borrow money domestically, the bank is taxed, so why should you have an unfair advantage over a domestic bank? Then there's a counter-argument that our banks don't fully pay tax and they have a low effective rate, so this puts them on par with that. I'm not sure how you answer that question. There are issues about the avoidance will never be closed. There are questions about international practice should allow a free flow of debt, because you'll have a central offshore treasury operation. And really, it's a question of balance here, what's more important to you. Now, one of the things that you need to take a look at in the next slide, and this is just a sample that we've done, is just to see some numbers that are going on here. But what you'll see over a two-year period is in mobile. We're not talking about the mobile stuff, the portfolio stuff, but when we saw the trade flows, the interest flows offshore, over a two-year period, just selecting a bunch of low-tax countries, we have about $18 billion going offshore, where that money is reducing our tax base, and it's exempt. And you'll see nice little countries in there, but you know, ones that we don't have a tax treaty with, countries like Guernsey and Jersey and Isle of Man, $439 million. This is over only a two-year period. This is a substantial revenue loss for the fiscus, and that's what is driving us here. Now, what you will see is that we broke this into treaty and non-treaty countries, and that gets to the next issue, and that is one of the difficulties that we have is that we have a lot of treaties with a zero interest rate in them. And the reason why we did that was our domestic loan is zero, so we went zero. Now we have a problem because they're in the treaties, and treaties are like fiscal stability clauses, and we're going to have to go back and renegotiate these treaties. And if you'll see here, we've got 8 treaties with low tax countries. That means they have a zero domestic rate of some kind or other, and when the money comes offshore and we exempt it, the low tax country exempts it, and then the money sits there tax-free. And those treaties are the main concern that we have. But the secondary concern is that even if we're dealing with a country that's got a high tax rate. So, for example, if you take a look at the United States, if the money goes offshore to the United States, even though we don't tax it, the U.S. taxes it, which means from global tax planning, you're not really better off, although we've ceded our right to tax to the U.S. What you have there is still a concern because sometimes people do treaty shopping through the United States or the UK. Now, the US and the UK have anti-treaty shopping rules. So you can't go from South Africa to the UK to the Isle of Man. If you do that, then the treaty doesn't apply. But you'll see on the next slide, we have a whole bunch of other zero-rate treaties where we don't have those limitations on benefit articles. Now, there is some OECD common law jurisprudence to prevent avoidance there, but it is more difficult. I think that area is under study, so we'll leave that one further. The revised proposal is essentially as follows. We are going to retain the initial proposal. However, we're going to make it a little bit more in line with international practice, and that is that instead of the original proposal said the interest would be taxed as ordinary revenue, at full rates of up to 28 or 40%. It's more consistent internationally to use a 10% withholding tax. It's also easier administratively. The reason why we didn't do that originally is we wanted the proposal to take effect as soon as possible. However, we have a treaty problem. And the problem is all the treaties have to be, a number of the treaties, especially with low tax countries, have to be renegotiated. And that's going to take some time. So since we've got to take some time anyway, we said, okay, let's convert this to a 10% withholding tax. So the effective date of the amendment is now 1 January 2013 in order to give us time for renegotiation. And then there are still some exemptions that we're tampering with, and I'm sure we'll be tampering with that for a little bit of time. But the basic proposal is retained. That's called the limitations on benefits. Sorry about that. That's an anti-treaty shopping clause. Yeah. All right. Now, this is a new proposal that wasn't contained in the bill, but was a collateral consequence of the bill. And that is, offshore, there are things called limited liability companies and limited liability partnerships. And those emerged in the late 1990s. They began in the U.S. The UK has picked them up quite strongly. A number of low-tax countries have them, and they seem to be spreading around the world. And what they are is they're an outgrowth of partnership law. And traditionally, the way partnership law works is that if you are a partner in a partnership, you are different than a company in that a partner has joint and several liability. So if the partner does something wrong, you can go after the partners. However, if you own a share in a company, people can only sue the company. They can't sue the shareholders. And the tax law has always made a distinction between the two and said that companies are taxed one way because of their limited liability status, and partnerships are taxed as another. And a partnership is taxed as a flow through, a conduit. So if the partnership is got income, it's treated as income of the partners. And that's the classic model of partnership taxation, and that law remains. However, what happened was people began to develop entities where they essentially got limited liability. So if you sue the entity, you can't be sued. But they had the benefit of flow-through treatment as a partnership for tax purposes. And that's called the limited liability companies and partnerships, where you got the best of both worlds. You had a flow-through for tax, and you had limited liability. What's happened here was this proposal came up, I think it's in the next slide, is that when we've had a number of changes that we've made to the tax law by virtue of other changes. We have a new dividends tax coming, and the Companies Act reform is coming. And so a number of questions were raised as to how do you tax a hybrid entity? And under current law, we're generally treating it as a company. It's not really clear. I think there's one ruling. There may be some other little things. But I think most people believe it's treated as a company. And the question is, should it? And after checking around and doing a little review and research, what we ultimately decided was that we shouldn't treat it as a company. Because even though there's limited liability, offshore, it's a partnership. And if you allow it to be treated as a partnership for offshore purposes and a company for our purposes in tax, you start creating difficulties. One area is, well, we had to clear it up because people weren't clear about the law, and so we've changed it. But what we've basically followed the approach that if you're treated as a partnership for foreign law, we will treat it as a partnership. We will follow that, and that's be in sync with international practice. It has two effects. One, it clarifies the law. Two, it actually reduces a lot of avoidance because there's a lot of arbitrage where people are treating it both ends against the middle. And one of the areas in international practice is to have two people treat the same thing differently. And there's a lot of arbitrage there. That shuts down. But there was also some very big concerns over another proposal that we had, and that was over regional investment funds. And the regional, we've created a rule to allow for South African partnerships to set up a regional investment fund using South African management. And under that rule, if you're a foreign investor, you'll be treated like a shareholder, effectively, and therefore your tax will be very limited. And that allows for South Africa to be a good place for regional investment funds. The problem with the original proposal, however, was that it only covered domestic partnerships, and it didn't effectively cover foreign limited liability companies and partnerships. And most of these investment funds want to do it through foreign limited liability companies and partnerships because they're foreign investments. By treating it like a partnership, essentially, we're allowing those things to work. And so it'll help that proposal as well. The only thing that's not on the slide is, because this is a fairly new thing that came late in the day, this proposal will not take effect until 1 October 2011 in case that we have unintended anomalies. And I think our biggest concern is some taxpayers might get caught into a transition problem where they were treating it as a company before and now as a partnership. And we need to make sure that if they're in that situation that they're not faced with an unintended tax charge. So that's that amendment. Anyway, I'll turn it now over to Seth. Or no, you know, the rollover one. You want me to cover that or you want to cover that? Okay. This is my last one here. Okay, the royalty bill. Now, the royalty is, again, fairly new. The royalty has been in effect since 1 March 2009. And as it's gone into effect, now that people have actually had to apply it, now all of a sudden all the anomalies are coming out. And there were two sets of anomalies that were emerging. One set of anomalies was that smaller miners often just extract the minerals out of the ground, but they can't add value because they don't have the facilities. So they send that mineral on to a bigger refinery or to a bigger company, and then the bigger company does the refining. And under current law, the first person who extracts and sells is the one that's taxed. And that created some serious problems for the smaller players. One issue was that if you don't bring the mineral to a certain level, you're subject to an extra charge. You have to have a minimum level of beneficiation. And the smaller companies can't do that, so the royalty had a double impact on them. The second concern that's not listed here is that there were worries about stockpiles, that if you sell a concentrate, what are you selling? And oftentimes you don't know what's in that mineral. And there was a lot of issues around there. Now, the original proposal did two things. One, it allowed a rollover relief that if two parties were subject to the royalty, they had mineral rights, that you could roll over the royalty to the other party. So if I sell to you, we can agree that you'll take the royalty instead of me. So if I'm the smaller player and you're the bigger player, you'll accept the royalty instead of me. And then you agree. The other one was we changed the definition of win or recovers, not win nor recovers, just win or recovers, and it's late at night, is we said that we were trying to eliminate all tax on residue stockpiles. But after much comment, people didn't like that win or recover because there was a 100 years of case history that we were violating and all of this. And so we ended up simplifying the proposal. And what we've said in the proposal, it's the revised relief, is that, one, you can do rollover relief as long as you agree. The second party doesn't have to refine the mineral anymore. In the first proposal, they had to refine. The second thing was that sometimes what happens is there are people who are outside of the royalty regime. There are miners who extract and then they sell on to manufacturers. And the manufacturers right now are not in the ambit of the royalty. And what we've allowed is those manufacturers to elect into the royalty regime and take the royalty as if they were original extractor. However, once you're a person who elects in, you can't roll it on because we don't want this thing rolled on endlessly. But we think that'll give people the flexibility they need to make it more so that we don't have the unintended consequences.
Thanks, Kit. The last big issue around the royalty was where we tried to draw a distinction between a refined mineral and an unrefined mineral. And so you'll see there are two schedules in the Royalty Act defining certain minerals as being refined and other minerals being unrefined. And there's different rates applied. For the refined mineral, we've got a slightly lower rate. And for the unrefined one, we've got a slightly higher rate. Maybe I should change. And the reason why there is that we don't want to discourage beneficiation. So when you actually beneficiate a product like gold, for example, or platinum, we give you a lower rate to discount the cost that you've incurred for the beneficiation. And so you'll find platinum is in both the Schedule 1 and Schedule 2, where if you sell it in concentrate, there's a higher rate, and if you sell it refined, there's a lower rate. For most of the minerals, that distinction was pretty clear. For a few minerals, we had a range where we specified that you have to sell it, you have to sort of develop it or beneficiate it up to a certain level to be classified as unrefined. So, because you can't have a value as you take it out of the ground. There's some processing taking place. And it was quite tricky to determine what is that level of processing that you have to do. And so in certain cases, we had a range. And then when the Act started to be implemented, there was a question of how do you interpret the range? Do you then have to adjust the value to the bottom of the range or to the top of the range? And what happened within the range? And it creates a few anomalies. And so what we have agreed to is, in most cases, to do away with the ranges especially for the two key minerals here, was coal and iron ore. And so we will say, in coal, where we had various grades from A to D, we said, okay, we'll have only one point, which is the minimum point. So if you mine below the minimum point, you have to adjust the value up to the minimum point, which is 19 MJs calorific content. However, if you mine above 19, we will impose the tax at the value which is at the point that you've mined, which will then be, say, for example, 20. But if you mine below 19 and you have to clean the coal and upgrade it to a higher level of 24, we will adjust it back to 19. So it's basically the value at which you mine it that becomes the trigger point. That was for coal, and for iron ore we did the same thing. We did away with the range from 61 to 64, and we decided to, for now, end up with a value of 61.5, and possibly going forward we might have to liquidate 5 years from now, because what is happening is as the mines get older, the quality of the ore gets lower, and so more expenses need to incur to upgrade it. And so that was the compromise we reached with those two minerals. No comment.
Thank you. A quick word from the SARS delegate. One of the key issues here relates around the ability of SARS to waive interest on underpaid provisional tax. Currently, we have a discretion that allows us to waive that interest on assessment if the taxpayer is able to convincingly argue that they had a reasonable grounds for taking the position that they did that led to the underpayment. Normally this arises where SARS has made an adjustment, and so the taxpayer and SARS have a disagreement. Now the problem that was articulated in the budget review and in subsequent documents was that interest really talks about use of money. So whether you had a good excuse for having the use of the money or not, the fact remains that you had the money. So the question of whether you have reasonable grounds or not is more appropriate for deciding should there be a penalty or not. If you have reasonable grounds, then there shouldn't be a penalty normally, or a reduced penalty. So having thought about it some more, the idea of doing away with the discretion altogether, which was the original proposal, does leave a bit of an anomaly in that there may be very limited circumstances where the fact that this has occurred is completely outside of a taxpayer's control. And that's something we've recognized in the Value Added Tax Act. And so it seems appropriate that instead of doing away with the discretion altogether, we now limit it to the kind of consistent discretion we've introduced in the Value Added Tax Act, which is circumstances outside of the taxpayer's control. And so that is something of a concession, but probably not as big as people would have liked. In some areas, people believe that this is very useful in helping them settle disputes with SARS. That may well be so, but there is an existing dispute resolution framework and a settlement framework that exists with proper reporting requirements if that's the reason you want to waive the interest. And we believe it would be more appropriate for that kind of thing to go through the settlement provisions. Obviously, this is all discussed in more detail in the comprehensive document.
Thanks, Franz. And Chair, a last issue which is not in the taxation or amendment bill, but we did brief the committee about a proposal on a CO2 vehicle emissions tax, and in terms of the legislation, we'll do it by way of a schedule to the to the Customs and Excise Act. And as indicated in the first slide, that schedule was published for comments in early July, and comments were received, and we will be publishing a revised schedule very soon. The comments were of an administrative nature. The one big comment that we received was the interpretation that we have used in the budget review and in the minister's speech about a passenger vehicle. What is a passenger vehicle? And here, the industry is of the view that we should restrict passenger vehicles to the narrow definition and that all light commercial vehicles should be excluded. We take a slightly different view, and then they said that vehicles like double cabs are mostly used for passenger purposes, and therefore and it's also recognized in the VAT Act, and therefore it's important that we do capture that. And there's a lot of arguments why the exclusion of double cab vehicles would create a distortion. There was also the question of whether the data is available for the emissions of these vehicles. We verify that it's available. And if it's not available, one can also use the proxies. Now, obviously, there's some bigger debate that's been generated about this that was debated last on whether this thing is appropriate or not. I think all the research that we've done say that this is probably the right path for you. And it's a very small step that we're taking. And that's it.
Can I just add, Chair, that just the one area that's also not covered in the bill on the voluntary disclosure, not on the tax side, but on the foreign exchange side, that's covered by the staff. They were here during our briefing, and they have since published a draft of the regulations or their approach on the staff website that is available. Thank you, Chair.
Thanks, Momo and your team. I want to propose that we have a leg stretch for 5 minutes so that we can come back and engage with the presentation. I'm sure tea is ready here. There's cold drink, and there's also snacks. Thanks.